Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Air Force One is hopscotching around the country for a couple of days. President Barack Obama is speaking about energy policy before audiences in four states. Today, in an interview with our Kai Rizdahl, the president said there are plenty of factors leading to today's gas prices.
Even if we're producing as fast as we can, we're still not going to see gas prices where we'd like them to be, unless we're also focused on being more efficient with the oil and gas that we have.
More from Kai's interview with President Obama in a moment. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdahl, and this is your Marketplace podcast for Wednesday, the 21st day of March, 2012. Today, President Obama launched a two-day, four-state energy tour. He started in Boulder City, Nevada, at the Copper Mountain Solar Facility, the largest in the country. The president's trip comes amid increasing concern from his campaign that rising gas prices could unravel his bid for re-election. My colleague and the host of this program, Kai Rizdahl, sat down for an exclusive interview with the president today in Nevada. Kai joins me now from there. Hi, Kai.
Hey, Tess. How are you?
Good. You're baking there among the solar panels, I assume?
Can I tell you, I'm a little worried, actually, about what the UV exposure is out here. We are in the Nevada desert. It is, there's a breeze, so it's not that hot. But, man, this is why they had the solar plant out here. It gets 320 days of sun a year, and we're having one of them now.
And that's why we call for sunscreen. Well, energy is, of course, certainly a topic around the water cooler, with gas prices putting a real crimp in consumers' wallets. What was the president's main message today?
Well, it is exactly as you said up at the top. He didn't say it explicitly. We got to his campaign and the politics of this whole thing a little bit, which you'll hear in a bit. But this is definitely now the Obama administration kicking into economic campaign mode. The president has, as you'll hear a bit later on, a strategy that he likes to call all of the above. He's out here at a solar plant today. He's going to oil pipelines tomorrow and renewable energy plants. And he wants this country to be energy independent by means of every available source. Can't just be oil, can't just be gas. And that's the president's message as he takes this trip.
Well, I know you had many more questions for the president, so I'll let you take it from there.
Mr. President, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thank you.
You were talking about your all of the above energy strategy.
Right.
But I wonder whether Americans aren't more interested in a one of the above energy strategy, and that is gas not at $4 a gallon.
Well, look, ultimately what Americans care about is the huge burden that it's placing on families right now. If you have to drive 50 miles to work, and yep. I hear from a lot of folks who do, then this is a real strain on budgets. So their most immediate concern is gas prices. But it's interesting, when you talk to Americans across the country, what they also realize is that there's no silver bullet. They want to make sure that we've got strong oil and gas production, and they're glad to hear that we're starting to make progress on natural gas, on additional oil production here in the United States. They also understand that if we've only got 2% of the world's oil reserves and we're using 20% of the world's oil, then the math is not going to add up unless we also develop the kinds of new technologies that are represented by this solar panel field out here.
Acknowledging there's no silver bullet, you get criticized by Republicans on their campaign trail. Your response has been, we're drilling as much as we can, more oil than at any time in the past 8 years. Is there more you can do so that it doesn't cost $55 to fill up your tank?
Well, the main reason that you're seeing the kind of gas spike that we're seeing right now has to do with uncertainty in the Middle East. So a lot of this has to do with the risk premium that's being tacked on. People aren't certain about what's going to happen with Iran. There's also been some tightening in the market because some unlikely places like Sudan and Yemen, they may only produce 100,000 barrels or 200,000 barrels, but when you add it all up, you've seen about 1 million barrels taken off the market. And what that means is that even if we're producing as fast as we can, we're still not going to see gas prices where we'd like them to be, unless we're also focused on being more efficient with the oil and gas that we have. So as you said, we're producing more than any time in the last 8 years. We've actually reduced oil imports to under 50%, and they're as low as they've been in a long time over the last couple of years. What we now need to do is open up additional sites for drilling, and we're doing that. We're actually, even on public lands, we've increased permitting by about 13%. But what we've also got to do is double fuel efficiency standards on cars. We're slated right now by the next decade to see fuel efficiency standards go up to 55 miles a gallon. That can save families about $8,000 during the lifetime of a car. We're going to have to make sure that we're using oil in our businesses a lot more efficiently. So if we add improved production with increased efficiency, then over time we can regain control over our energy supplies.
With all respect, it was kind of a gutsy move, I think, to come to a solar facility. Your administration has staked a lot on clean technology, green jobs. The biggest item most people know about that strategy is, of course, a company named Solyndra, which your administration gave loan guarantees to that then went bankrupt and has been the subject of many investigations. Are you doing your all-of-the-above strategy right if that's what we have to show for it, Solyndra?
We are doing the all-of-the-above strategy right. Obviously, we wish Solyndra hadn't gone bankrupt. Part of the reason they did was because the Chinese were subsidizing their solar industry and flooding the market in ways that Solyndra couldn't compete. But understand, this was not our program per se. Congress, Democrats and Republicans, put together a loan guarantee program because they understood historically that when you get new industries, it's easy to raise money for startups. But if you want to take them to scale, oftentimes there's a lot of risk involved. And what the loan guarantee program was designed to do was to help startup companies get to scale. And the understanding is that some companies are not going to succeed. Some companies will do very well. But the portfolio as a whole ends up supporting the kind of innovation that helps make America successful in this innovative 21st century economy. Do I wish that Solyndra had gone bankrupt? Absolutely not. And obviously it's heartbreaking what happened for the workers who were there. When you look at the overall portfolio, is it right for us to make sure that we're not just cashing in our chips and letting the Chinese or the Germans develop the technologies that we know are going to be critical in the future? I'm proud to say that we're going to continue to support it.
You said when you were campaigning in 2008, you were going to spend $150 billion on green tech and clean energy and create 5 million clean energy jobs. You didn't get there.
Well, we haven't gotten there partly because this thing interceded called the Great Recession. We had the worst financial crisis and the biggest drop in employment and the housing market. Obviously, the bottom fell out of it. And so we've spent a lot of time digging our way out of that hole. Part of it has been a clean energy strategy and investments that we made because of the Recovery Act, the investments that are being made as we speak, help to account for the kind of solar facility that we're seeing right here that is creating jobs right here in Boulder City.
Let me ask you about the labor market. Unemployment is down from its high during this administration. It's now 8.3%. There are still millions of people, though, unemployed. Long-term unemployment is becoming a structural problem in this economy as people lose the skills. What more can you do, and what more should the government do to create jobs in this economy?
Well, there are a bunch of things we should be doing. You're right. We've made progress. The fact is that over the last 24 months, we've created almost 4 million jobs. We've seen more growth in the manufacturing sector than any time since the 1990s, about 400,000 jobs created over the last couple of years. And so the trend lines are good, and one of the most important things that we needed to do was to make sure the economy was growing. But you're right that we still have way too many people unemployed. There's still some headwinds that we've got to deal with. I'll give you a couple of examples. Number one, the housing market's still probably the biggest drag on the economy. Now, what we've done administratively is allow people to start refinancing their homes to take advantage of historically low rates if their mortgages are held by one of the FHA programs, mm-hmm. Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. The problem is that that only captures a portion of people who could be refinancing, saving $3,000, putting more money into the economy and creating more jobs and getting the construction industry back up and running. So we've called on Congress to make a change that would allow everybody to refinance right now. That's something that would create jobs. Second example. Infrastructure. We've got a couple of $1 trillion worth of improvements that need to be made right now all across the country. Interest rates have never been lower. Contractors have never been more desperate for work. Construction workers are idle at home when they want to be working. For us to engage and embark on a major infrastructure development program right now not only would put people to work as we speak, but it would also pay huge dividends in terms of economic growth over the long term. So the issue here is not that there aren't things we can do to put people back to work, retrain them for the jobs that currently exist. The challenge is that Congress is going to have to think a little more boldly than they have been and get past some of the partisan name-calling that has become a habit in Washington. If we do, then there are a bunch of things that we can do to put people back to work.
Let me use that as a pivot then and ask you about the Republicans who are currently campaigning for your job. I don't know if you watched TV last night after the Illinois primary. I'm sure you got a briefing this morning. Both Mitt Romney and Rick Santorum made the case that their platforms of economic freedom are the way to go. They say you're not doing enough. They say you haven't been doing enough. You shrug, but that's, you know, I mean, you know what they're saying. So the question is, make this close the sale, right? Because you keeping your job in November is going to be depending on how people feel about whether you did it or you didn't do it as you promised 3.5 years ago.
Look, you know, I think at a time when people are still out there struggling around the country, where unemployment is still too high and a lot of folks are still worried about their mortgage, their home being underwater, nobody, I think, can claim that we are where we want. But I think when the American people think back to the last 3 years and where we've been and where we're moving towards now, when you ask them what has more likelihood of succeeding, a policy in which we're providing additional tax cuts to the very wealthiest Americans, who are the only folks who've benefited from any significant income growth over the past decade, stripping away regulations that help keep our air and water clean, defunding things like education that we know are going to help us to be competitive. When you ask them, is that a recipe for long-term economic growth, their answer is going to be no. And when you turn to them and say, should we be investing in school reform that puts more money in, but also demands greater accountability and makes sure that we're investing in teachers? Should we be rebuilding our infrastructure? Should we be investing in clean energy technology? Should we be investing in basic research and science? And should we pay for that and get our deficit under control with a balanced approach that gets rid of programs that don't work, but is also making sure that folks like me are paying our fair share of taxes? Then that's the recipe that they have a lot more confidence will allow us to be competitive in the 21st century. So the debate is going to be joined. I think it's going to be a healthy one. But the fact is, we've tried what they're peddling. We tried it in the decade before the financial crisis. Shoot, we tried it before the decade before the Great Depression. And historically, that recipe, that sort of on-your-own economics that is now being warmed over in this campaign, has not been a recipe for American greatness and American economic success.
Mr. President, thanks very much for your time, sir.
I enjoyed it. Thank you very much.
Appreciate it.
Kai Ryssdal speaking with the president today in Nevada. You can hear more of their conversation, this time on healthcare policy, tomorrow on the Marketplace Morning Report. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed after a quiet day of trading. We'll have details when we do the numbers. Word has it that the economy is out of the critical care unit and in recovery. Hiring is up a little. Housing prices are rising here and there. All over the country, we're hearing stories of comebacks, big and small, as we stagger out of the Great Recession. In a special collaboration with the New York Times, we're bringing you the Comeback Chronicles. In tomorrow's Times and on this weekend's Marketplace Money, we're telling stories of people who made huge adjustments in their lives to ride out the downturn. Today, we travel to Williston, North Dakota. The town has made a comeback thanks to the billions of barrels of oil that lie underground. But the benefits of a boom have a dark side. New York Times reporter Ann Carnes has our story.
Williston Mayor Ward Kozer is dealing with the kind of growth most mayors would envy.
We've had people from all 50 states, and they can find, man, in a day or two, you can find a great job. You can probably pick your choice of jobs.
Unemployment is at just 1%. Local businesses are thriving, but the growth has come at a high price. The population has nearly doubled to more than 20,000 in the past several years. People are so desperate for housing, they're sleeping in their cars. Thousands more live in temporary housing called man camps on the outskirts of town. There's three times the traffic, lines for everything, and the place is covered in a film of gritty sand thrown up by the 9,000 semi-trucks that barrel through Williston every day.
The stress that's here today is difficult on everybody. There's no, you can't minimize that. It's just, you know, we're dealing with sewage, we're dealing with roads and water and streets and people and housing, and there's just all kinds of issues.
One of the issues is fear. Fear of getting hit by one of those semis. Fear your landlord is going to triple your rent. Or worse. In early January, just on the other side of the Montana border, a woman named Sherry Arnold was abducted and presumed murdered. The two men charged with her kidnapping were on their way up from Colorado to work in the oil field.
Well, it changed how many of us behave here.
Kristen Mortensen moved here from Idaho in October with her husband and two-year-old son.
It certainly hits right at the target of the resentment of folks who've been in this area, a good, wholesome, safe area, as to what these new people bring, which is drugs, bad behavior, and really, really scary things that can happen.
Rumors of assaults and rapes abound in Williston. The county sheriff's office says more people have applied for concealed weapons permits so far this month than did in all of 2010. Kristen Mortensen.
Many women have been buying pepper spray, stun guns, and all kinds of stuff like that. I haven't gone that far yet, but I don't leave the house at night.
A group of longtime Williston locals get together after church for Sunday brunch. Dan Baker is nearly 80 years old. He's seen the town through two previous oil booms and busts. He says some of the new residents may look pretty rough, but he's seen the type before.
There's no reason to be afraid of these people. They're good people. They're coming to town to find a job to help support their family.
His friend Chuck Wilder takes a positive view of the newcomers, too. He wants them to stick around, bring their families here, and help Williston thrive long term.
The town historically has always been either really booming or it's kind of flatlined, and I'd like to see a normal growth.
But Williston's growing public relations problem is getting in the way and giving Mayor Ward Kozer a headache.
And I always tell people, and it's not like I'm encouraging them to stay away from the bars, but if you stay away from the bar, you're probably going to be fine.
Probably may not be good enough for Patrick Schneider. He lives in one of the man camps just outside town. He's considering bringing his wife and three-year-old daughter out from northern Minnesota, but he's wary.
You know, I'd hate to move them out here and then have something happen. You know, that'd just be horrible.
We're a safe community. I still believe that, and we're going to work hard to make sure that that stays the case.
Time may be on Kozer and Williston's side. Some experts estimate the oil companies will be pumping for decades, giving the town plenty of time to catch up with its own furious growth. In Williston, North Dakota, I'm Ann Carnes for Marketplace.
The full Comeback Chronicles will appear in tomorrow's New York Times and this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money. Coming up, the public library is no longer just about checking out books.
I used to be one of the people who used to pretty much keep their hygiene up here in the restroom, you know. I mean, you got to wash your face, you got to brush your teeth.
But first, let's do the numbers. Disappointing housing news pushed Wall Street into mixed territory today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 45 points, 0.1% to finish at 13,124. The Nasdaq gained 1 point, basically flat, to close at 3075. And the S&P 500 fell 2 points, 0.1% to settle at 1,402. Existing home sales declined in February. That led to a bumpy day for stocks, and energy companies led the market down. Chevron drained 1%. Exxon dropped 0.6%. Other stocks also dragged down the market. Food maker General Mills lost 0.4%, with news it faces more expensive raw materials costs. But there was a bright spot for a stock that's been ground down recently. Green Mountain Coffee buzzed up 10%. The company will expand its deal to use Starbucks coffee packs in its single cup machines. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.29%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Statebook, here's a look at events coming up Thursday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators. The Senate Armed Services Committee discusses the situation in Afghanistan. And thirsty? The United Nations marks World Water Day. This year's theme focuses on the relationship between water and food production. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Tess Vigeland in for Kai Rizdal. Today, Starbucks CEO Howard Schultz addressed the company's annual shareholders meeting. Along with plans for boosting revenue, he discussed how business can be a force for social good. Commentator Robert Reich says it's a discussion that is long overdue.
The biggest moral crisis in America isn't about the private decisions Americans make about who to marry or when to have children. It's about the violations of public trust at the highest reaches of our economy. Last week's broadside by a former Goldman Sachs executive charging the firm with putting profits before clients was seen as sour grapes by some, but it came on the heels of Goldman's admission that one of its bankers acted as a merger advisor while holding stock in one of the two merging companies, a blatant conflict of interest. After gutting the Dodd-Frank financial reform law, Wall Street has returned to many of the sleazy practices that brought on the 2008 crash. And all of this comes at a time when executive pay continues to soar, and both Wall Street and big corporations are pouring record amounts of money into political campaigns. Some conservatives call private moral decisions they disagree with shameful. But the abuses of public trust on Wall Street and in the executive suites of our largest corporations are breaches of public morality, and they are shameful. They undermine the integrity of our economy and our democracy. Twice before, reformers have saved capitalism from its excesses by appealing to public morality. First, in the early 1900s, when the captains of industry dominated the economy with giant monopolies and presided over sweatshops. And then again in the 1930s, after the stock market collapsed and one out of every four Americans was left without a job. It's time for a new era of reform based on public morality, to crack down on conflicts of interest, rein in exorbitant pay, stop banks from gambling with their customers' money, and reverse the Supreme Court's decision that allows corporations and the well-heeled to buy elections through unlimited political spending. Today, Howard Schultz plans to stand up for the importance of morality in business. It's something all of us should get behind. After all, public morality depends on what happens in America's boardrooms, not its bedrooms.
Robert Reich teaches public policy at the University of California at Berkeley. His most recent book is Aftershock, The Next Economy and America's Future. Tell us what you think. Go to marketplace.org and click on Contact. Step into pretty much any city library in America, and you'll find all kinds of people in the stacks. Students, retirees, and the poor and homeless. Libraries aren't just for books or movies anymore. Increasingly, they're a place to turn for job skills, shelter, and now some social services for people who have nowhere else to go. Julia Scott has more.
A few years ago, the San Francisco Public Library started seeing a flood of homeless people sleeping in the study areas and washing up in the bathrooms. David LaFleur was one of them.
I used to be one of the people who used to pretty much keep their hygiene up here in the restroom, you know. I mean, you got to wash your face, you got to brush your teeth.
David LaFleur is 51, and he's been homeless for 6 years. These days, he's living in a group home with the Dry and Sober program. But he still uses the library's computers every day to look for a job.
Let me get my resume. And these are some of the jobs that I was applying for yesterday through Craigslist. This is a driver warehouse position.
Main branch librarians found they had nothing to offer LaFleur and other people who came in asking for help. So 3 years ago, the library hired the first social worker in the country based out of a library.
Let me just check this out for you here.
Her name is Leah Esquera.
What I've learned from being here is that the library's goal is to include everybody, to make the library accessible for everybody, and not to screen anybody out.
Other libraries have added social workers, too. That's because city libraries find themselves on the front lines of the national recession. Lisa Gieskes is coordinator for the Housing, Homelessness, and Poverty Task Force at the American Library Association.
Well, libraries are a public service, and the communities that we serve are dealing with a poverty rate of over 15%, according to the last U.S. Census.
Gieskes says for newly unemployed Americans, just having access to the internet is a big deal. In recent years, libraries have added job skill centers and resume tutoring, too.
You can actually see spikes in use in, you know, library usage with the recession because people know that we provide a free service.
not just free books, but free programs. In North Carolina, Bridget Blanton runs something called the Winter Series for the Greensboro Public Library. It all started a few years ago when the library invited homeless folks to eat inside to get them in out of the rain. Then they asked their homeless patrons what else they needed. The answers were a little surprising.
We were like, oh, great. We can do job and career counseling. We can teach them how to use the internet. But some of them were trying to find out where they could sleep that night.
So the library started meeting people's basic needs. It got nurses from a local university to do blood pressure screenings. A dentist donated dental kits. It did haircuts, too.
And you're saying, it takes a haircut. Where are they going to get the funds for a haircut? We take those things sometimes for granted.
Libraries, of course, face major budget cuts. Some have lost funding even as they start to add programs for homeless people like David LaFleur.
You know, we're constantly fighting for resources and to make sure that these resources don't get cut off. You know, pretty much that's where I'm at, you know, fighting for my life on a constant basis.
The library is still a place to come for answers. That's why David LaFleur will be back tomorrow. In San Francisco, I'm Julia Scott for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
And this final note, the New Orleans Saints were marched to the woodshed today. The National Football League suspended coach Sean Payton for a year without pay and fined the team $500,000 as punishment for a bounty program that paid bonuses to players for injuring opponents. ESPN reports the suspension will cost Payton some $7.5 million. The league said payoffs included $1,500 for, quote, knockouts that took opposing players out of games. Bad voodoo for the city that is hosting next year's Super Bowl. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Our engineers include Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bradford Craig, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, and Brendan Willard. Tune in tomorrow to the Marketplace Morning Report for more from President Obama and the latest in business and economic news. I'm Tess Vigeland. Hope you can join us back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.